Yeah, hi, I'm Bill Jacob. I'm the lone algebraist, at least so far, appointed to talk in this series. And I actually do hope that we have conversation and it evens out with an equal number of physics talks at some point, right? Because what I'm going to talk about is algebraic K-theory, I put together a list of references of things that you might want to look at and things that the titles look very appealing, and while there might be a nugget or two in them that's useful, most of it might not be useful. So I tried to give you some heads up on that. And the three, I've got the appendix from High Bass, four chapters from Huesemuller's fiber bundles, which has a lot of the basic stuff that was talked about in the first talk presented in greater detail. I learned about fiber bundles from the books, and so maybe that's why I'm partial to it. But and then a more recent book by Jonathan Rosenberg, I have a section where he discusses some connections to topological K-theory. And I left one copy here. So if one of these three starred things strikes your fancy and you want a copy, then you can go to the appointed location and I'll keep copies in the math. Okay? All right. So I won't go through that list. I've made my comments. You can read them. Yeah. So I want to talk about algebraic K0, K1, and their relation. To topological. And I guess maybe I'll put a little K0 up there. K minus 1. Okay, we've heard about topological K0, and I will give us a start on topological K minus 1 today. The point is that even if you're really, your interest lies here, okay, which I, my impression is that's where the interest of most people is lies here. There's a rich history here. People have been working in algebraic K-theory for some 30 years, and I think a lot of the ideas that evolved to solve problems here have influenced the development here. So you should at least be conscious of them. Okay? And if you're interested in algebraic geometry, okay, then the two fuse together. Okay, very heavily. So, more on that when we get there. So, there'll be two parts. Part one will be rings and projective modules, K0, K0. Okay, so I'm not going to make a definition. But R plus dot will be a ring in the algebraic, in the sense of algebra. Okay? Just in case there are other senses of rings. I know there are other senses of fields. So I'm going to be careful. What is a ring? You can add things together. You can multiply things. The distributive laws are good. The main point is you don't have multiplicative inverses. Okay? And that's very natural, and you'll see why in 1 second. They need not be commutative. Not have a commutative dot. Okay? Although the rings we will be using today do. Okay? And I think the example, which will be used today, is let X, let's just make it a compact manifold, although do it with any space, okay? And then R is going to be CX is going to be the ring of continuous functions. And then, well, I won't take any chances. I'll limit myself to real or complex value functions on X. Okay? And just to make sure, you don't get confused with some other rings. The operations. The operations are induced by the field operations. In other words, it's simple-minded if you have... How low do I dare go? I guess we can go pretty low here. Since I tend to write big, I mean, if you have F and G from X to R, say, what is F times G applied to a point P? Well, you just evaluate, okay? There's no... Occasionally people get confused. They're thinking of rings of operators or something. But there's really no other way to add and multiply rings. And if, and of course you note, if a P is zero for some P, this implies F is not invertible. Okay, and that is actually very, very important. All right, so those are rings. And now, for fields, algebraic fields, all right, we have vector spaces. Those are pretty familiar. So you just do the same thing for rings, the same for same thing, same definition essentially for rings. Gives what we call modules. Okay, so you can scalar multiply a module element by a ring element, and you can add module elements together. Okay, and in the event the ring's not commutative, we have to worry about which side we're multiplying by. So you have left and right, but we won't worry about that. Okay, and of course the simplest example is the free module, and it's important to us. The free module Rn is exactly what you would think, okay? N tuples, okay? And I'm not even going to write out the operations because they're exactly what you would imagine, right? Just component-wise, add things together, right? It's the additive structure from R here. Okay, and then when you multiply through, you multiply everything through just like Rn, right? I mean, okay. Free modules are very important because they enable us to define projective modules. So an R module P is called a projective module.
So just to slow you down. Just
sure. Like
the multiplication on the free module is just component-wise multiplication?
Yes. Yes. Yeah. So
there's a scalar multiplication. There's no multiplication.
There's no multiplication in the module.
Oh, it's not in the module. It's just by the...
So, you know, R times
okay, yeah.
S1 to Sn is, of course, RS1. As you know, Sn, but you don't multiply module elements,
okay.
Right?
But these are all things I can do with vector spaces too. I guess should I care about the difference between the module and vector spaces?
Yeah, because these are more general.
They're more general
because why? Sorry. You can't necessarily undo the scalar multiplication because the ring elements might not be invertible. And also,
this next definition is going to clarify, because I'm going to try and say everything in terms of vector bundles anyway, okay, or examples. Okay, it turns out that in K-theory, and even if you're just a topological K-theorist, if you're interested in this ring at all, you're going to be interested in the projective modules. And an R module P is called projective if there exists a Q, another R module, such that P direct sum Q is isomorphic to Rn for some n. And that might even begin to look a little bit like some of the K-theory things that we've been doing. Let me give you a non-K-theory... Well, actually, you can turn all this into K-theory. Let me give you an example that doesn't relate to vector bundles, but is very simple. So you see there's something non-trivial here. and then we'll go directly to vector bundles in a minute. If you have a field, then you have a vector space. Projective module turns out to be just a subspace. Okay, and in fact, so I'll put that down. If R is a field, then all projective modules are free. That's because they are vector spaces, and vector spaces, finite-dimensional vector spaces, have bases. Well, all vector spaces, because vector spaces have bases. Okay. Now, let me give you an example of a non-free module that's very simple, you know very well. Let's suppose R, I'll just make it 2x2 matrices, but obviously it's n×n matrices, but then I don't have to write a big matrix, right? So 2x2 matrices over a field. Okay. And then I can let M1 be A, B, 0, 0. A, B, and F. And M2 be 0, 0. C, D. Now, of course, I don't need to put these zeros in. I could just think of them as two vectors. Right? Okay. And we multiply on left, because this is actually the one non-commutative ring I'm writing down today. Okay? If you take a 2x2 matrix and you multiply it by, on the left times one of these things, you get one of these things again. It's a module. And it's obvious that M1 direct sum M2 is isomorphic to R. Okay? Two copies of these things can be viewed as isomorphic to R. It cannot be free. Because
the M2 of the
N2 of the given, right? Well, they're both isomorphic.
Yeah, we're starting with M2 out there. Is the two matrices over a field, and M2 is
a... Oh, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry. It's a different M2. Yeah. Let's make these N's. My apologies. Those of you that have been in my classes know that I like to use the same letter over and over and over again. The alphabet's too small for me. All right. And let's make these ends. Good. And we'll just remind you. Just now we'll get it back. Okay.
M1 and M2 are modules which are somehow parameterized by A and B in the field.
This
is a collection of
matrices. It's a collection of matrices with zeros there and there. And this is a collection of matrices with zeros there and there.
So you might want to put a parenthesis.
It's a set of those things.
Yeah. Right. And you might wonder, well, gee, maybe this could be free. You know, I've shown it's projective, at least if you believe that line. But if you count the dimension of this vector space over this field, R is four-dimensional, and this is two-dimensional, so there can't be an isomorphism between it and free module. It's a very simple example, but it shows that this notion is not trivial. Okay.
Question.
Yeah.
So the general paradigm that we should think of projective modules as sets of sections of bundles on X.
Of course. And of course. And that's exactly what I'm going to do next. So now, here's the main point, at least. And this is known as Swan's theorem. And it's really, in some sense, it's my main point for today. Everything else that I can get in, I'll get in. Okay? I'll use the mathematician's language, but I'll also try and diffuse it. The category I know you hate that, but the category. But I need to call it something. That's the thing. The objects have to use a noun somewhere, right? The category BX of vector bundles on X is equivalent, which I won't define exactly in what sense it's equivalent, but you'll see in the proof, is equivalent to the category of finitely generated projective R equals C of X modules. Okay. And we've already heard the proof. I've been preempted, but I'm teasing you. We'll go through it. But what is this category? It means you take the collection of all these vector bundles. And we also talked about maps between vector bundles. They all have the same base space, by the way. Okay? You fix your base space. You look at all your vector bundles. And that's what we use to build our K-theory out of. So you might as well just pretend you're an algebraist and do C of X modules. Okay? And as we will see later, this is very useful in understanding higher K groups. Later, of course, maybe. Not today. But. So I want to say something about the idea of proof. Okay, so this idea of proof will also reinforce definitions that maybe I haven't made. Okay. Let pi map e to x be a vector bundle. Okay. And then I like the geometer's notation, or the algebraic geometer's notation. Let p equal gamma xe be the set of all sections. From X to E. So we've talked about the importance of sections earlier. Okay? I think everybody knows what a section is. I won't go into the definition. Then, P is an R module because of the vector space, structure in the fibers of pi. Right? Because each fiber is a vector space. So I can, if I have S1 and S2 mapping X to E, well, I can actually say, what's S1 plus S2 applied to a point P? Well, I can just take S1 of P and add S2 of P because they lie in the same fiber in this addition and scalar multiplication structure. Okay. And note the following. Suppose E is in fact, let's just say X cross Rn or Fn. I'll just use R for my field today. Everything's completely general. It's trivial. Then, someone hazard a guess as to what kind of a module P is. Free, right? And P is a free module. Okay. And with basis, I haven't defined what a basis is, but you can guess the coordinate function. Well, let's see. That's pretty vague, but I think you can guess what I mean. It's the function which assigns to each point P, the first basis vector, and then the second basis vector, and so on, because you've got this uniform. Okay. So that's free, but then you want to ask, but why? But why is gamma p projective in general? Because right, the whole point is to think about non-free things. So there's a little bit of work to do, which I will sketch. All right. So now X is compact. It's a compact manifold, so don't worry about. So a topologist would know it is normal. Okay. But so there is an open cover. Oh, finite. That's very, very important. A finite open cover, let's just say UI, I equaling 1 to n, finite open cover, where pi restricted to, oh gosh, now notation gets crazy, right? Pi inverse UI. Pi inverse UI to UI. Put in those I's. Almost better maybe not to write that. Right. It's trivial. Right. Right. That's the whole point. We have these local trivializations. And it's compact, so we only have, we know a finite number of them work. Okay. Now, we use a result, which I hope physicists are willing to believe. Mathematicians will know this as a partition of unity. I don't know. Does this come up in physics? Partition of unity? No. Anyway, I'll write it down. What? Yeah, sure. Absolutely. Yeah. So I'll write it down. In particular... Well, you have to sketch some proof in a general talk like this to give you an idea that there's reasons behind things, right? Okay. In particular, there is a partition of unity. So what do I have? These are FIs, and they map X to R. Let's see. These are one for each UI, the sum of the FIs, I cling one, I took N of them, is the identity function 1. And if I look at FI outside of UI, it's 0. Okay? So the support, we say the support of this function is inside there. So they're just bumps, right? And they're all aligned so that they add to 1. Okay? A standard game for a proof like this, actually. Okay? And now, I'll tell you the idea. Because when you start writing down the symbols, you lose track of them. So the whole point is, each one of these is locally trivial. You take the standard basis for each one of those. Multiply it by FI. Now, it's a section on the whole thing. Of course, it's 0 outside the set. And then you take them all together. And what you've shown is it's finitely generated. All sections are finitely generated. The set of sections is finitely generated.
It's finitely generated just because the cover is finite.
Mm-hmm. Because the cover is finite. Exactly. So let Sij be bases, be local bases, let's just say, of gamma of the notation. Local bases over the UI, and then combine these sections Sij dot F, this has got an I, together to find a collection of elements to find a finite of gamma. Gamma XE that span it as an R module. So, well, you have to use this condition to see that it really spans. You take a section, right? You multiply a section by one, and that's still the same section, okay? And then you write it as a sum of these things times the FIs, and then each of these FIs times the thing can be written as sums of these things. Okay? Kind of dramatic, get the geometric picture. So, now it's finitely generated. Why is it projective? Well, what did we have? We have n of these, and if it's locally k-dimensional, for each I, we got k of these, right? So we have, let's say, n times k sections spanning gamma, I'll just abbreviate. And so we obtain a bundle map, a vector bundle map, from X cross R in K to E. Okay? Just taking the independent thing here. Okay? Well, then if I don't follow my notation, I'll start using the wrong notation in the middle. I give it a name, E prime. Let E prime be the kernel of this map on what do we mean by kernel? Right? This is a map of bundles, right? We have a commutative diagram like this, right? That's always sitting there. And so above each point of B, it's just a vector space map, right, on the fibers. But we can talk about the kernel of that linear map.
B is X, right?
B is X, thank you. Jeff is on top of me all the time. Yes. Sometimes B is base space. But I'm trying to stick with X. Quick. All right. Well, actually, that's pretty good because that's something inside something free. When we think of the sections of this, we know the sections of this to be free. Okay? So, now, last time the question was asked about Riemannian metric, okay, during the talk. And so, in the first chapter of this Husmuller, there's discussion on what a Riemannian metric is. But this thing has a Riemannian metric, and it's really trivial. What we're saying is that you make each fiber into an inner product space in a continuous way. Well, it's pretty obvious what you do, right? You just use the inner product there. So, has a Riemannian metric. So, what we can do is we can take the orthogonal complement of E prime at each place. So, can form E prime perp inside X cross R in K. And then you just check that's E. This is a sketch, but so E prime plus E Whitney sum is isomorphic to X cross R in K, and the sections of E perp plus the sections of E, they add together to be the sections of vector cross R K, which of course is free. So it's projective. Okay. So that's how, what?
E prime perp is actually the
check E prime perp. Good. Yes. Okay. So that's a very elementary use of the Riemannian metric, but it gets us there. And now, quickly, something about the converse. But the hint is already there. So if P is a projective, C is X module, right? P plus Q to B, this is R. Rn. Okay. But this Rn is gamma. Rn. Right? This is the global sections of this. So, now, form the vector bundle span by images of sections from P. Okay, so you've got, these are now sections on this big thing. Well, they point in various directions. At each fiber, they point somewhere, so you take the vector space they span at each fiber. And, of course, you have to check local triviality. Must be checked. But to do that, you just use a continuity argument. Use continuity argument, which I won't give, although it's not hard. Basically, you take a point, you take a basis, they all come from sections, right? And then there's some subdeterminant of a big n by n matrix, which is non-zero, saying that those things are linearly independent. Oh, this NK? Okay, so we had NUs. And I remind you what the N is. And then each, the bundle is rank K. Okay, so over each U, the bundle looks like U cross R to the K. I make no claim that this is the best possible bound. Okay? No claim whatsoever. Okay, this is a continuity argument. And that's Swan's theory. So your vector bundles and the modules of sections are the same thing. And it goes a little bit, I see your hand, it goes a little bit beyond. That's okay. It goes a little bit more than just saying they're the same things if you have maps. You see, and of course in K-theory you're interested in all the relations. Got to worry about maps between vector bundles. They correspond to projective module maps in every sense. That's what the category word is about. Have a question, comment?
Yeah, so if I were to drop projectivity and look at arbitrary or more general finitely generated things, would that correspond to some kind of maximally extended sections of a sheaf?
Oh yeah. So if you want to do algebraic geometry, then you're in a new ball game. You don't have this homotopy property anymore for vector bundles. So we have things called algebraic vector bundles, But if, and they correspond to projective modules in exactly the same way. We also have things called coherent sheaves. And that's more general. They correspond to more general modules.
Does coherent give you a maximality property?
Well, I'm not sure what you mean by a maximality property. Maybe we can talk afterwards, yeah, rather than getting off into this. But, yeah, one of my remarks is going to be that one has opportunities to extend this, extend your work in K theory to more general categories of things. And I'll say a little bit about that in a minute. But I want just to, here's a corollary, because you need another example of a projective module that's not free, right? If we look at the sections of the tangent space of the two-sphere, this is projective, but not free. As a CS2 module. There you go. Right? And this is an example we had before. We know that this is not a trivial bundle, although it goes away in K0. This is an example you always want to give your algebra students when you talk about projective modules, but you can't. So, fun for me. So here's the game. If R is a ring, we can now form K0 of R. And I'm going to set it up a little differently because you're stuck with an algebraist for the day. But F is what we call the free abelian group with generators, isomorphism classes of projective modules. And then REL is a subgroup, which I call REL because they're relations. It's the subgroup generated by, if I have a projective module, I have a class. I have another projective module. I have a class. I want to kill things that this is supposed to be equal to. So I do that. Okay. Okay, and then what Swan says tells us that K0 of X is nothing other than K0 of C of X when you chase out what everything is. So now we have K0 of a ring. And so this is just an aside, right? We now have K-theory of rings. Enables one to look at, well, one, algebraic varieties. So I think people are getting more interested in algebraic geometry. So we have K-theory of algebraic varieties, several K-theories. Okay? You can also do non-commutative rings. And this is actually, at the moment, one of my interests. There are these certain quantum rings that algebraists have been studying. Okay, a quantum projective plane, for example, is something that I've studied. You can also, they're rings from number theory. And I only mentioned that for one reason. You can have K0 wiggle, which is the kernel onto the rank. And if I take the integers here and I add a primitive P through to unity, theta to the P is 1. I guess I should have just written e to the 2 pi I over P. Well, 150 years ago, roughly, I think, Jeff, for about 150 years ago, Coomer made an error. Right? He thought he proved Fermat's last theorem. Well, his error was that he assumed this was 1, and it's not. So took us 150 years to correct the proof, but just for your amusement, if K-theory had been invented 150 years ago, I wouldn't have made that mistake. So, this idea shows up in many places, okay? In algebraic geometry, I don't know if you come across the word pick. Okay? But if you've come across the word pick, it can be understood as a certain subquotient of K0. So, this context of rings from a mathematician's point of view enables you to extend these ideas to lots of places. And that's just a remark. Okay, so I have about 15 minutes.
Does this have something to do with unique factorization?
You nailed it, exactly, yeah. If this K0 is 1, then you have unique factorization, and otherwise it does not. Yes?
Since you're writing it additively, you really need 0, just the trivial group.
Yeah. Okay. There's always an ambiguity in mathematics where the 0 is 1. All right. Okay. Good. All right. Maybe I'll make this remark now because I probably won't be able to. When you have a ring in a geometric setting, even in the setting that we're in right now, I should do this remark. It'd be more useful for what's coming up. So if you have a ring of continuous functions on some topological space, okay, some manifold, and suppose you have a submanifold, okay, then you can look at the functions that vanish on that. Okay? So you might look at I equal the set of F and R such that I of y is 0 for some y equals some closed subset.
F of y equals 0.
F of y, yeah. Y being a closed subset. This is what we call an ideal. Okay? And in fact, if X is suitably nice, the ideals, in some sense, capture the closed subobjects, okay? And the maximal ideals capture the points, all right? And you can do the following. You can consider I as a ring without... without one, because you don't have the identity element in there. Usually when we construct rings, we have a thing, one, that multiplied by everything else is X, the identity. Well, you obviously don't have one here, because it has to vanish to something. But you consider that, and then algebraic K-theory shows that K0 of I to K0 of R to K0 of R mod I is exact. Okay, I'm not going to go through this. But it gives you an approach to seeing that now K0 x minus Y to K0x to K0 of y is exact. And this is one of your Eilenberg-Steenrod axioms. This should be a minus. This is one of your important axioms in a general cohomology theory, which K-theory satisfies. And I think at a later point, one of the talks will deal with this exactness here. And once you understand, well, Well, you have to understand where this sequence comes from here. But once you understand the exactness here, you see it's just exactly the same thing here. It's a translation. Okay.
Your proof
of the equivalence of the algebraic and topological K theories sort of leaned on having a ring with unity. So why do you get to do this?
You get to do this because
the one still lives in the bigger.
Right. The one still lives here. Okay.
So when you do the partition of unity, it somehow inherited.
And then this K theory here, this is no longer compact when you extract this closed set. This is this K theory with the compact supports that we heard about last time. Okay, so maybe I write that down. Okay. Good. All right. So that concludes part one and leaves me about 8 minutes for part two, which I will have to abbreviate a little bit. But I do want to say something about K1 of R and K minus 1 of X. Okay? Now, I had planned to give some details on this, but I'll leave the notes so that, you know, if you can decipher my scrawl, that will help. But we need a definition of what K minus 1 is, because we haven't gotten that yet. And K minus 1 is K0 of the suspension of X. But I've got to tell you what S1 wedge X is. So, aside, if XP, YQ are pointed topological spaces, X, and I immediately drop the P and the Q, they're hidden. X wedge Y is what you do, is you take X cross Y. The Cartesian product is a space, but then you put the P from X and pair it with all the Y's, and you take all your X points and pair them with the Q's, and you contract that to a point. So this means you contract the point. And now is where I have to draw a picture that people want later speakers could come back to. And if you've done this stuff before, you know this. But if you've never seen this operation before, you'll probably have to accept on faith that the picture I draw is a good representation. S1 wedge X can be understood as a union of two cones. Okay, and so let's see. I'll write out how that works. S1 wedge X. Now, what is S1? I is the unit interval. Identify endpoints. And then we wedge that with X. And that could be understood. I take this interval and I break it into two pieces. Okay. And then I go 1/2 1 cross X. And here what I've got to do is from the zero with everything, I get 0x here, okay? And I have to add here 0.5 with a point P. And here, I'm going to write it in the other order. I've got to have 0.5, 1 with my point P. And I've got to add 1x here. Okay? Chase it out. It can be thought of that way. And now, what is this? These are both what we call two reduced cones. They're each a reduced cone. We get two reduced cones. C of x, C of x. Because what we've done is we've taken x, crossed it with an interval, pinched the endpoint together. Then there's some junk that slides together. That's why a reduced cone. If you didn't have this, it'd be a real live cone. Okay? And if you draw the picture, if you draw the following picture, you pretend x is S1. Because after all, I'm not necessarily an artist here, but if we think of this as x, and I'm going to save space to put another x here, this is our, you know, 0.5 here. Of course, it got pinched to a point, but here's our 0.5, 1. Two cones, and what happens? They get glued along a copy of x. Okay? So, a little sketchy, but now, this should look like something we saw in the first lecture, right? It looks, at least when that's S1, this looks like S2, right? Okay? And it should, because S1 wedge S1 is S2. Okay? And what about vector bundles on a cone? Well, this is contractible, so they're all trivial. Okay? So vector bundles on each cone. Cone are trivial. Bundles on each cone are trivial, so we can generalize this clutching function. That we heard about. The clutching function was really just looking at a map at from X into GLNR, telling us at each point how to glue trivial bundles together. So VB on vector bundles on S1 wedge X correspond to homotopy classes. This is the exact equation that was written down 2 weeks ago of maps, except with an X in it. X, G, L. Well, I'm going to put a K here, R. So now I write K vector bundles. Rank K. All right. Now, this is your invitation to higher K-theory now, okay? Because I know people are interested in this K-1, okay? So here's what an algebraist does. An algebraist says, well, we can take a direct limit over K. So now, K wiggle minus 1 of X is identifiable with homotopy classes mapped from X to GLR. This is just a direct limit. You map GLN and the GLN plus M by just adding the trivial matrix along the diagonal. But the algebraist says, oh, wait a minute. What is a homotopy class of maps of X into such a thing, or even for GLK? Ah, turns out two maps are homotopic, but then only if they lie in the same connected component of GL R, where R is the continuous function on X. So if we're looking at homotopy classes, it turns out we're looking at connected components. GLR. And in a suitable topology, compact open topology, the connected component of the identity turns out to be the subgroup generated by elementary matrices. By an elementary matrix, we mean ones along the diagonal, and you're allowed to put in some non-zero something off the diagonal. Okay? And you can see those things are connected to the identity, because if you've got all identity things and you've got something, some little non-zero thing, then you can just multiply that by numbers from 0 to 1, right? And that contracts it, the identity. So this is, in 1-1 correspondence with elements of GLR modulo ER. Well, actually, I'm fibbing a little bit. These you have to worry about positivity and negativity of functions. I should have picked complex scalars. All right. But let me just write down the punchline, since you've been very patient to hear this last little bit. So it's just a quotient group. I'm writing it down right now. Let R equal a ring. GLR is what you would think. It's the infinite general linear group. ER equals a subgroup generated by elementary matrices. Okay? And then we have K1 of R is, by definition, GLR modulo ER. Okay? Because we're mimicking this situation here, and then there is an exact sequence, and so I'll erase my fibbing, okay, and then I'm going to stop. So if R is C of X, then K1 of R, which is this thing, which an algebraist can at least write down, and you can kind of imagine, that maps to K minus 1X by the description I made here, right? But actually, there's a kernel here, and I'll give it the notation I have in my notes. U of R plus, and this is these are the functions. Taking a positive value at all entries. Okay. So it's a little more in the notes. You do have to worry. I mention this only because, although I didn't understand it, in part two of these notes, in part two I found the proof but didn't understand what it was doing. So I just mention this is a non-commutative group, right? Highly non-commutative. K groups are supposed to be abelian. And they are. ER turns out to be, so this is just a remark, ER turns out to be the commutator subgroup. Okay, just A, B, A inverse, B inverse thingies. Okay, so this is known as the Whitehead lemma. And I found the computations that are the guts of the proof of the Whitehead lemma in section 3.1 of this paper. Although I didn't understand at all what was going on in the sections, I did find the computations, the exact computation there. So there's some relationship. And I think that's enough. Thank you for paying attention.